It has a name. Baradis, Kessler, Rejek, devouring all life, all light, a hunger that will never die. Rejek! Rejek!
Bridge to all decks. Time for a brand new episode of Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. I'm Scott Nance.
And I'm Steve Morrison. It seems like we've had adventures, we've faced monsters, we've faced gods, and now we're in like a serial killer detective story. It's an entirely different genre for the Starship Enterprise.
This episode is a collection of genres.
Right, yes.
And it's absolutely different from anything we've seen, except maybe for Cat's Paw, because it is coming from the same writer. Of course, we are talking about Wolf in the Fold. And this is an episode that I've always really, really liked. Maybe not as up there as the two previous episodes
Right. We've
talked about, Doomsday Machine and Amok Time, but it's one that I've always really enjoyed. So after watching it again for the first time in quite a long time, I still have to say that, yes, I still very much enjoy it. There are things that definitely jumped out at me that I didn't really think about before because it's been a while. But overall, Steve, I do really like Wolf in the Fold. And I think it's interesting that after filming Moby Dick in space
Right. With
Doomsday Machine, now they're doing Jack the Ripper in space
Yep. With
Wolf in the Fold. But what are your initial thoughts?
Well, again, I've always liked it. And I like this one in sort of a weird, campy way, too, because there's certain things in it, particularly when we get to the fourth act,
Yeah. That
are just very fun in a very odd way and very quotable. There are a few lines in this episode that my friends and I said for years.
Wow.
Absolutely. So I have always liked it, and it was really interesting watching it this time. I have some new thoughts about it.
Yeah, that makes two of us. But I got to say, though, so this episode is written by Robert Block. It's his third and final teleplay for Star Trek. His first is What a Little Girl's Made Of, and his second is Cat's Paw. Cat's Paw was the episode. It was the first episode they shot for season two. We've already talked very in depth about Cat's Paw, and I think of the three that Robert Block wrote, I would say that this is second best after What a Little Girl's Made Of. Definitely better than Cat's Paw.
Yes,
but like Cat's Paw, I see it as a guilty pleasure kind of Star Trek episode, but still better in a lot of ways. And I just always liked the look of this episode. Of course, I mean, not an episode goes by where we do not sing the praises of Jerry Finnerman for his cinematography. And this is an episode that definitely benefits from that. But it's also the feel of it, the mood of it. I remember when I was a kid, there were a couple points during the episode where I genuinely got scared. And even as a grown up watching it, I think of the nostalgia of when I got scared as a kid. And that kind of makes me scared again. But this is a Scotty episode.
Yep.
Not a Scotty episode like we will sort of come to expect after seeing him take charge in
Doomsday Machine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Doomsday Machine for sure. But it is interesting how this episode shifts tones from being a slasher, horror, gothic horror, courtroom drama, comedy.
Yeah.
All shifting tones over the course of 49 minutes, not including the ending credits. But like I said, so this episode was written by Robert Block, directed by Joseph Pevney. I would say that Joseph Pevney, when it comes to trying different things, he was a great director to do that with because he had directed so many great episodes of Star Trek by this point. So it aired on December 22nd, 1967. It was the 43rd episode to air, but it was actually the 37th episode to film, which it did during six production days between June 27th and July 5th, 1967. And because of when it was filmed, it made me think of Argelius 2 in a whole new way. And I see you're going, what does he mean by that?
Yeah.
And I'll get to that in a few moments, especially when you do your current events during that time. The episode cost $189,718. So it went over budget a little by 4,718. But for the first time in season two, during the production of the episodes, the music was actually tracked, meaning that it was lifted from other episodes. No original score was recorded for Wolf in the Fold.
Interesting.
So as I mentioned, Robert Bloch wrote the story, and he wrote the story outline on April 20th, 1967. Gene Kuhn revised his outline the next day, and then Bloch wrote two drafts, the second of which came in on June 1st. Gene Kuhn did a rewrite in the middle of June of 1967, and then Roddenberry came in and did a revised final draft teleplay on June 21st. So like I said, this is Bloch's third Star Trek teleplay, and this was adapted from his own short story, which was titled Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, spoiler alert, from the Weird Tales magazine from 1943, and it was also adapted into a 1961 episode of Thriller that was also called Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper.
Interesting. Would you like to know some of the things going on in the world while they're making this TV show?
Can't wait.
So this was, as you said, shot between June 27th and July 5th in 1967. On June 27th, and I cannot believe that this is this early, the very first ATM was introduced at a bank at Barclays in London in 1967.
I always thought of those like as things like in the 80s.
Early 80s is where I kind of thought they happened, but no, 1967. Yeah. Carl Wilson, the lead guitarist of the Beach Boys, was acquitted of draft evasion.
Oh, wow.
And what's interesting to me about that is, I don't know if you remember, but last week's current events, Muhammad Ali was found guilty of the exact same crime.
Wow.
Now, I'm not going to comment on why one celebrity got acquitted and the other celebrity found guilty, but it is sort of interesting. On June 28th, Israel passed a law that all of the holy shrines in Jerusalem would remain open to all of the religions. And this is obviously huge. Jerusalem is a holy city for three of the world's great religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And Israel said, we're not going to get in anybody's way. I think that's awesome. On the same day, Pope Paul VI ordained 24 new cardinals. One of them was Carol Wittlia. I never know how to say his name, because what we really know him is Pope John Paul II.
Oh.
He was made cardinal then, and he later, of course, became a saint of the Catholic Church. On June 29th, Jane Mansfield died in a car accident.
Jane Mansfield. One of my favorite movies of all time is The Girl Can't Help It.
Oh, I've never seen it.
That movie is great. You and John Rocha should actually do a Cinephiles episode on The Girl Can't Help It. It is an absolutely great rock and roll movie and has just so many great rock and roll greats like Little Richard, Eddie Cochran. You should definitely check it out. I think you'll like it a lot.
No connection whatsoever, but the day after Jane Mansfield was killed in a car accident, Pam Anderson was born.
Oh, I see where you're going with that.
On July 1st, the BBC began broadcasting in color. And I wonder how long it took before they had Star Trek in color in England.
Oh, you know, that is a great question. I seem to recall that BBC started airing Star Trek, I think in 1969. I could be wrong. Anyone listening, please feel free to correct me on our Facebook page. But I believe the BBC started airing Star Trek in 69.
Interesting.
But they already had Doctor Who, so.
Well, there you go. So this is a great science one. On July 2nd, we were, of course, really concerned about the Russians developing nuclear warheads, and we wanted to find out about nuclear testing. And so we launched two satellites, Vela 3 and 4, and they were designed to detect gamma radiation, which if you blew up a hydrogen bomb, there'd be a big blast of gamma radiation. Here's the data they get from the satellites. Every 2 weeks, there are huge blasts of gamma radiation. And the Americans at first go, oh, my God, how many bombs are they blowing up? Is it maybe it's Russia and China? What's happening? And, of course, it took a long time to figure out. But 30 years later, they had confirmed that those bursts of gamma radiation came from other galaxies, that they are the most powerful, most violent explosions in the known universe. is creating these gamma radiations had nothing to do with nuclear bombs on the Earth.
Well, so when we talk about an episode like Gamester's Triskelion, or That Which Survives, which throws the Enterprise across the galaxy, or you know, it kidnaps Kirk and Uhura and Chekhov, you know, the providers take them. Like, that's actually pretty plausible.
Okay. Plausible. We'll see.
By Star Trek standards.
By Star Trek standards, sure. We're back in Israel, and of course, we're continuing to deal with the consequences of the Six-Day War. And this is July 2nd, and Israel announces to all of the Palestinians who fled the West Bank during the Six-Day War, which is a lot. They left their homes. They said, you completely can come back. You have a full right to return until July 4th. They gave them 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah, 2 days. How was this information even distributed? I mean, you imagine that they're in refugee camps in Jordan or something like that.
Yeah, they can't check their email.
Yeah, you know, and so, and you know, we look at, because, and again, I'm trying not to be on a political side. You and I are both Jewish, but the origins of all these conflicts, they just go deep. They go really, really deep.
Yes, they definitely do, and they're still just as complex as they ever were.
Also on the 4th of July, homosexuality was decriminalized in England and Wales. Unfortunately, it only affected men. Lesbianism was still illegal. It did not apply in Scotland or Northern Ireland or the armed forces or the merchant marines. And another interesting one is that the age of consent, if you were straight, was 16. But if you were gay, it was 20. So it's just so remarkable, these things that to me and to you, I'm sure, are just like, well, of course people can be in love with whoever they want to love.
Love is love is love.
But this is 1967, and man, still could go to jail.
Well, on that same date, on July 4th, 1967, my parents, Larry and Arlene Mance, celebrated their fifth wedding anniversary.
Oh.
Isn't that cool?
That's nice.
Yeah,
that's
1967,
very nice.
Yep.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
Here's another cool science one, is that three university presidents met at Ohio State University to discuss the very first online computer network to connect libraries at universities. This is before the internet. This is before the ARPANET. This is one of the very beginnings of this idea of, hey, wait, we could connect our computers and share knowledge.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's same time as the ATM. I didn't realize that any of that stuff happened at the same time.
Would you like to get into Wolf in the Fold?
Yes, 100%.
You know, we talked about how there's certain episodes that start in a completely different way. We start with the dancer.
And that was such a big bone of contention for Stan Robertson, who was the NBC executive assigned to handle Star Trek. And he kept saying to the producers of Star Trek, I don't want to see another shot of the Enterprise in orbit. I want to see something where they're on a planet already. Mm-hmm. And boy, did he get something very different with the opening. I love the opening of this episode. I love seeing that dancer. She's so sexy, you know, and for a kid watching that, like, that's how you watch the Star Trek. And then hearing the music, which I later realized was lifted from the Cage during Vina, the Orion Slave Girls dance. Of course, you're wondering, would you ever wonder, who is that?
Of course I wonder.
Mike, are you kidding? Of course we did. So that's Tanya Lamani. And she was on TV, fittingly, in an episode of I Dream of Jeannie.
Naturally.
I mean, that makes perfect sense. She was also on McHale's Navy and The Bionic Woman. And I never knew what her name was, what the character's name was. Did you know?
I had to look it up so I could put it in my notes.
Yeah, it's Kara. Kara?
Kara, Kara, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know until I was doing my research that she actually given a name.
Yeah. What's so funny to me, it's always funny to me, like, what we worry people will be offended about, like, what's okay, what's not okay. And the fact that we can have these ridiculously scantily clad women in these insane outfits in Star Trek, but you can't show a belly button. The world would go insane if they were to see a belly button.
And it's funny you mention that, because Tanya Lamani said that while she was filming that scene, that thing kept coming out. It kept dropping out. So they kept having to do the takes over and over again. Now, Now, when we were talking about the production information, I mentioned that the score for this episode was tracked. All the music was lifted from other episodes. Obviously, the music here is lifted from The Cage during Venus Dance. But what I did not know until doing research for this episode, that Gerald Fried actually did compose a new score that was supposed to accompany the nightclub dance, and he recorded it during the sessions for A Mock Time. But the producers decided, after hearing it, you know, that music from The Cage, The Menagerie, sounds pretty good. And I think that music is great.
I wonder if the music that he scored for this ended up getting used somewhere else. You know,
that the music, all of the music that was ever recorded, whether it was used or not, is on a 15 CD box set of music. It's came out, I think, in 2012, and it's like this landmark release for fans of Star Trek. Like every single solitary music cue that was ever recorded, and I think it's sold out. But you can buy them on Amazon or eBay.
I've heard of that website. And what we have is Kirk, Scotty, and McCoy are sitting in this cafe. They're watching this dance. They're obviously enjoying themselves. Scotty, in particular, seems to be enjoying himself.
Captain, I think I'm going to like Argelius.
Obviously, a man of good taste.
Now, what is your take watching Kirk and McCoy and Scotty in this, you know, setting? Like what did you think of when you first started watching this episode for the first time after a while?
Well, what's so funny is like I think this is definitely one where as I became an older guy, like I started to go, wait, what goes on in Argelius? Like what kind of a place is this? You know, and certainly sailors who sail into a new port, there are definitely stories of the kinds of places they might want to visit.
Debauchery.
This is definitely a debaucherous. What it's funny is when you hear more about Argelius, you know, it's like Risa in there's the one that's mentioned too in Mantrap, where he talks about, oh, you remind me of this girl.
Wrigley's Pleasure Planet.
Wrigley's Pleasure Planet.
Yeah, you're right.
So there are these places where clearly ships know to go.
Yeah, the starships go to, you know, they do shore leave.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a really good point because when I was watching this and you know, you really get into Argelius, like what they're doing there. And you know, they're there for therapeutic shore leave for Scotty, which we'll get to in a second. But then it occurred to me, The and I mentioned this about when they shot the episode. They shot the episode at the end of June and the beginning of July 1967.
Right.
What was going on?
Summer of Love.
The Summer of Freaking Love.
Mm-hmm.
And that never occurred to me watching this if they got caught up. You know, like Gene Kuhn and Robert Block and Roddenberry, you know, when they rewrote Robert Block, like to kind of put that aspect of it, you know, the Summer of Love into a Star Trek episode in a subtle way. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, you know, they, you know, looking to blow off some steam and have a good time.
It's funny. I don't think of it as Summer of Love at all. And of course it could be, and who knows what was in these guys' heads. But to me, this is much more military who'd served in World War II and served in Korea, ending up at a port where there was a lot of a culture that was maybe different, where you could have a good time in a way that maybe
I'm going to lean into your assessment of that. Sure.
Well, and this next line is kind of what sells me on it, because Scotty says,
"Do you mean to tell me that all these women, well, that all this is?"
Yes.
Which, of course, they're not saying. I mean, are these women? Are they all going to get to have sex with these women? I mean, is that the implication here? That's kind of what it sounds like
they're
saying.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah, that they're, you know, he's just kind of dancing around it, and Kirk just goes, I know where you're going with this. Yes.
Well, and we hear the Argelians think very highly of their pleasure.
Oh, now that's an understatement if I ever heard one. This is a completely hedonistic society.
So, yeah,
what's
going on here.
Right, right. They're actually not being subtle about it.
And Scotty is definitely paying attention to that dancer. And Kirk says, good, because I've invited her to join us at the table. I thought you'd like to meet her. And Scotty, just beaming, says,
now that's what I call a real captain. Always thinking of his men.
And just let's just look at, so Scott is very much a prominent character in this episode.
Yes.
After being a very prominent character in the Doomsday Machine, where he is like I don't think there's another episode where Scotty has really shined as the miracle worker.
As the engineer, yeah.
Yeah.
And she continues her dance. It's very sexy. The music climaxes, and then the song is over, and everybody starts blinking their lights except Scotty, who starts pounding the table.
And no one has to tell him how to applaud, Captain.
And I'm like, no, someone clearly does have to tell you how to applaud, because you don't do it with one hand. Applause is two hands clapping. Right. You obviously don't know how to applaud, Scotty, unless that's how they do it, those old Aberdeen pub claws you're talking about.
'Tis a fine foggy night tonight, and I doubt if anyone has ever told you of the marvelous fogs we have in Aberdeen.
Never a word, but I'm dying to learn.
Well, then why don't I show you? There's nothing like a walk in the fog with a bonny lass.
Or a handsome gentleman.
And off they go, looking very happy. Scotty looks very happy.
My work is never done. My work, Jim.
Now, my work almost didn't happen for McCoy, because in the earlier versions of the story, McCoy wasn't very prominently featured. So it was actually Bob Justman who pushed Block and Kuhn and Roddenberry to make McCoy feature more prominently. And that's when Dorothy Fontana said, why don't you put him there right at the very beginning in the nightclub, so he's there when things go wrong for Scotty.
That makes perfect sense. And I think McCoy is super important. And we're about to go into a bit of dialogue that I think is terrible and really problematic.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because the more I'm thinking about Cat's Paw, it makes sense that this same guy wrote this, because what we hear basically is that Scotty's had some kind of accident. There was an explosion. He had a head injury, and it was caused by a woman.
Physically, he's all right.
Oh, yes, yes. And matter of fact, considerable psychological damage could have been caused. For example, his total resentment toward women.
That line made me cringe.
It is so terrible.
It made me cringe. You know, here's an episode that I watched many, many, many times over the years, but not recently. And hearing that line that, oh, because he was injured and happened because of someone who happened to be a woman, so now he's just going to have total resentment towards women. So that's why they're down on Argelius, because of what McCoy called therapeutic shore leaf.
A thing which we never see. We see no indication whatsoever that Scotty has any resentment towards women. This is exactly, you know, I've talked about show, don't tell. This is tell, don't show.
Yeah.
I'm telling you a thing that is important for you to know. It makes no sense. And what I'm thinking, what was the complaint about Cat's Paw? I don't understand what's happening. Why are these people doing what they're doing? This is exactly that kind of problem. And you know how every once in a while I rewrite some Star Trek?
Do it.
I have rewritten this.
Okay.
So what bothers me is, first of all, tell, don't show, rather than show, don't tell. Is that, and because one of the ideas is, do we want to question whether or not Scotty is capable of these murders? And I think the show is telling us that we should question a little bit.
It's definitely telling us.
But we're never at any moment do you actually think Scotty might be responsible for these murders. Never a chance. So here's what I do first. First of all, Scotty's not having fun at the cafe. He doesn't want to be there. And the woman comes over and he is rude to her.
Oh.
And she goes away and Kirk says, you know, Scotty, you know, we're come here to have a good time. And Scotty goes, you know what? I have a lot of work to do on the ship. Why don't I head back and work on my engines?
Yeah, do his technical journals.
I got a phase 3 diagnostic to do on the whatever. Kirk basically orders him, no, you're here to have a good time. I want you to go talk to that girl. That's an order, Mr. Spock.
Like, for example, in The Trouble with Tribbles, which we haven't gotten to yet, when they're doing the shore leave over on Space Station K-7, Scotty originally did not want to go. Mm-hmm. He wanted to stay behind on the Enterprise and catch up on his technical journals.
Yep.
And Kirk ordered him to go to keep the other crew members in line. He's like, okay, all right, Captain.
And that's what I think
that's
what
should have happened here.
And then Scotty reluctantly now goes over to talk to the girl. Instead of being happy and flirty, he's awkward and uncomfortable. And they're watching, and now I'm going to do a thing which they would never do then because it's dealing with continuity. But this is what I would put in. Instead of he got hit and he was injured by some woman and now he has total resentment towards all women, is they're sitting and McCoy and Kirk are watching him go, looking concerned, and Kirk says, "I wish he could get over her," and McCoy says, Well, what do you expect? He was literally willing to fight a god for Lieutenant Palamas.
Oh, my God.
He got shocked, thrown multiple times, blows to the head. He was practically killed, and she barely noticed. If I were him, I'd probably prefer a nice, safe engine room, too.
That would have been perfect. That would have been perfect to reference the...
An actual experience that happened a couple episodes ago.
That we saw recently. That would have been amazing.
And again, look, I know it's arrogant. I'm rewriting a show that you and I adore. It's one of the greatest shows of all time. And I'll say what I said last time. They had to put out shows every single week.
Yep.
I've had my entire life to watch this episode and think about this. But the other thing that happens is that then what you said is it's not just that Scotty, you actually do create sense that, oh, maybe Scotty is really messed up and maybe his experience with Paulo really messed him up and he really did kill this girl. But Kirk feels guilty because he ordered Scotty to go out with this girl.
Oh, right, right, right. Oh, yeah, right, right. That would have made things more complex for Kirk. He would have had a vested interest,
exactly,
because he basically ordered Scotty just go and have a good time with her, and he would have been like, you know, felt responsible,
exactly,
because he's responsible for his crew, and he ordered one of his crew members to be with this woman, and now that woman is dead.
Yep. And I had McCoy say, I know you want to help him, Jim, but sometimes pushing can do more harm than good. And then they see Scotty walking out of the cafe with the girl smiling. And Kirk says, you were saying, doctor? And McCoy says, what do you expect? I'm a doctor, not a matchmaker.
Oh, dude. Dude. I love it. I love it. We should just do a whole other version of Enterprise Incidents where Steve Morris rewrites the entire series.
Well, you know, I'm available for script doctoring anytime anyone out there has a, you know, high-paying gig. But that is not what happens.
Of course, in my professional opinion, when he gets back to the ship, he's going to hate you for making him leave Orgilius. But then he will have lost total resentment toward women.
You know what I was thinking about, by the way, is that, you know, and you would know much more than me, I wonder how much Gene Roddenberry rewrote What Are Little Girls Made Of?
Oh, well, he wrote the first half of the first season. He rewrote every script.
Yeah.
He rewrote a lot of that.
Because Robert Block's other two episodes aren't that good.
That's a good point. But Roddenberry did do a rewrite of this one.
Mm.
So he was still involved. You know, he wasn't, I mean, even though Gene Kuhn was the showrunner, Roddenberry was still very involved.
Bones, I know a little place across town where the women. Oh, yes, I know the place. I know the place. Let's go.
And they get up. We've already discussed the kind of place I think they're heading towards.
By the way, when they walk out, they're on Orgilius too, but they could have been in London. In the 1800s.
Sure. Absolutely. 100%.
It looks like London. It's a misty. It's foggy. It's dark.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect setting for what we will eventually discover is the breeding ground for Jack the Ripper.
They run to where the scream was. We find Kara, the dancer. She's on the ground. We get a...
She's dead, Jim. Stabbed. Dozen times.
And then we hear a groan. We look over, and it's Scotty standing against the wall in shock with a very sharp object in his hand.
And I think, despite my objections to some of the wonky writing, I think the end of the teaser is great.
Yeah, it's great, a great teaser. Definitely is a great teaser.
We are back in the cafe in Act One, and we get to meet the chief administrator, Mr. Hengis.
I don't know what to say, gentlemen. Orgilius is the last planet in the galaxy. I'd expect a thing like this to happen.
So Mr. Hengis is played by John Fiedler, who is a very recognizable face and a very recognizable voice on TV. His incredible career has spanned Tom Corbett's Space Cadet, The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, The Twilight Zone, Bewitched, The Bob Newhart Show, The Odd Couple on TV, and then on film, he was in 12 Angry Men, Girl Happy.
Oh, that's right. He's in 12 Angry Men.
He's in 12 Angry Men, yes. Girl Happy with Elvis Presley, The Odd Couple feature, True Grit, and he was the voice of Piglet in the Winnie the Pooh movies.
It's me, Piglet.
Of course he's the voice of Piglet. It's such a recognizable voice.
Totally is.
Yeah.
But, you know, not once did you hear Piglet ever go, Rudgick, Rudgick, Rudgick.
Die, die, die,
die, die, everybody, die.
We're just as shocked as you are, Mr. Hengis.
This was my home planet, Rigel IV. I'd have a dozen investigators working on the matter. But they don't exist here.
He's from Rigel IV. So keep that in the back of your head.
And what we hear is the reason that he's from Rigel IV is that the Argelians always hire their officers from other planets because they're a very gentle people.
Not so much on Rigel IV, apparently.
Mr. Scott? Now, are you sure you've never seen this before?
I don't remember.
I think James Doohan is great in this episode.
James Doohan is great in this episode. Now, Steve, try and imagine Sulu saying these lines.
Oh.
Because in the earlier versions of this story, Sulu was the one accused of murdering the women. And guess who suggested, we got a better actor here in James Doohan. It's got to be James Doohan. Bob Justman.
Interesting.
Robert H. Justman pushed for Scotty to be the central figure in this episode. No slight against George Takei at all, but just that with all, especially the second season, the episodes we produced so far, James Doohan has definitely...
He's expanded.
Expanded.
And Sulu has contracted.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I wonder, we obviously all know there is decades of resentment between George Takei and Shatner. I wonder if he knew about this and if he was irritated that Doohan was taking his stuff, because we've heard this multiple times now.
Yeah, we have. But it was actually Bob Justman who made the change or initiated the change, not anyone else.
I'll tell you, this is just my gut reaction to that. I think it would have been a better show if it was Sulu.
Why?
I really do. Because he's younger, because he's more, I think it would be more interesting to see him more frail. Like, I think, and part of it is because, like, we didn't love what they did with Scotty in...
Who Mourns for Adonai.
Yeah. Is that I think he's playing the vulnerable stuff really well. But I think where Scotty shines is where he is the miracle worker, where he's just the super solid guy. That's where we love seeing Scotty.
Yep.
Where Sulu's been pushed around a little more between the naked time, between the other experiences that he's had. And I think that it might have been more interesting, and there might have been a more paternal situation between Kirk and Sulu if his young, up-and-coming, really great prodigy crewman was in this situation.
That's a really good point. It would have been interesting to see how the dynamic would have changed between Kirk and Sulu versus, Kirk and Scotty. But I think all the performances in this
episode
are great.
Yeah, no, great. Totally.
So, yeah.
We were walking in the fog. I was up ahead trying to lead the way. I heard the girl scream. I remember starting to turn. I don't remember another thing.
Scotty, you got to remember. Jim.
And McCoy pulls him away and says... If he says he can't remember, he probably doesn't know.
But you don't think by any chance that Scotty doesn't make any difference what I think.
And what we hear is that this is the thing that you've brought up before. You think so much like a soldier, you forget you're also a diplomat. Well, this is Kirk the diplomat. He's saying there is a whole political situation here on this planet, and I got to deal with it.
I literally have it in my notes.
Oh, do you really?
That in this episode, Kirk was more of the diplomat.
Yep.
It's not promising, Captain. Mr. Scott insists he remembers nothing. But my detector readings indicate that only his fingerprints are in the murder weapon.
Yes, Mr. Hengist, there were other people in the cafe.
All right, I have an important question. I'm going to ask this question many times.
Let's hear it.
Who killed Kara?
Who killed Kara?
Yes. Who stabbed this person?
I'm going to say, wait a minute. Hang on a second.
Yes.
Nobody. No person did the actual stabbing. Because when Scotty did remember... I think it was during the killing of Sibo. Okay.
Okay.
He said, remember, he said, I didn't pass out this time. I heard her scream. I went to go for her, but there was something in my way.
Mm-hmm.
Not someone, something. So I took that to mean that when it's in its sort of gaseous state, and it, like in this case, left the host body to kill whoever he was going to kill, or it was going to kill.
So what I think is, I don't think they actually knew. I don't think they really figured this out when they wrote, because it's definitely not consistent. Because we also know, and again, spoiler alert for this 1955-year-old show, but there is this evil entity that also was the Jack the Ripper, who has lived for hundreds of years preying on women, and that it has the power to possess other people.
Right, exactly.
Because we see that at the end of the show.
For sure we see that.
Scotty does not remember what happened. He is holding the knife. It's possible that Scotty did kill Kara, and that is why he didn't remember.
Oh.
Because he was taken over.
Well.
Because he does remember the SIBO one.
But he remembers SIBO. He remembers SIBO.
SIBO.
But he would. So, okay. That's a really, really great point. So if Red Jack,
yes.
Jack the Ripper, Baratas Kessel, whatever you want to call it,
right.
has this ability to possess people.
Yes.
To be in a gaseous state. And that gaseous state is what Scotty experienced when he went to grab SIBO.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the other times when he doesn't remember?
Well, exactly. Well, and it's going to bring up, and this is why we have to keep asking this question, is who is Hengist?
Right.
Because we, to be really clear, and it's great casting and great writing, we immediately don't like this guy.
Immediately don't like this yeah. guy, and certainly quickly learn to not trust him and be suspicious of who he is.
But is Hengist Hengist, or is he Red Jack?
Is
like we can believe, and well, we could table this for now because this is a question we're going to have to think about as we go along.
But it's a great question because Hengist has the memory of Jack the Ripper.
He does.
Yeah. Well, he's Hengist is okay. Okay. This is a great question because you're making me think about this episode in ways that I never thought about it. So Scotty doesn't remember anything about the first two killings.
Yes.
The third killing, he just remembers that something was right. in his way. Okay. So it's quite possible that Scotty was possessed by Regek
yes.
and doesn't remember it. And Scotty's physical body actually did kill these first two women.
Yes.
But it's not his fault because he was possessed.
Right.
And he, you know, doesn't remember anything about it anyway. But when it comes to Hengist is throughout this episode totally opposed to everything that Kirk and company want to do to get Scotty off the hook.
Right.
Because I always saw it that Hengist
is
the bad guy and possessed by Regek, but not in a way where it doesn't cloud his memory. So if Scotty doesn't remember anything about the first two killings, then it's possible that Regek was possessing him. But why, when it was possessing Hengist, why was his memory not messed up?
How do you know it wasn't?
I don't.
Well, this is the thing. So I want to go forward in the scene because we're going to come back to this question because it's
a great question.
Because there's other stuff that happens that we have to think about.
Okay, wait. I just want to say
yeah.
for everyone listening, so this is a great question for everybody, for all of our listeners. Do you think that Scotty was actually possessed by Regek, Jack the Ripper, whatever you want to call it? Do you think that Scotty was actually possessed and actually killed the first two women and just doesn't remember anything about it because it was not really him? Do you think that Scotty's body actually
right.
made the move to kill the first two women?
Yes.
Let us know on Enterprise Incidents.
And then in the background, we see Jarrus, the prefect, enter with his wife, SIBO.
The outlook for your friend is quite grim.
What is the law in these cases?
And Jarrus says,
"The law of Argelius is love."
And at that moment, Steve, that is when I went,
oh,
the summer of love. But like, imagine, Steve, well, I mean, I know you've done this just as many times as I have at this point.
Exactly the same number.
Right. Yeah. You're watching this episode that you've seen hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody says something or does something and you see something. It makes you go, oh, well, this was the moment when I went, oh, maybe the summer of love did influence
sure.
the writers to kind of make more gilius.
I think for that line, actually, I'm totally on Team Scott on this. I think there are elements of the sailors coming to shore at the port and finding the women. That's here, too. But when he says the law here is love, I'm with you.
Oh, and by the way, just as he was saying that, I thought to myself, are you of the body? the body is good.
Yeah.
Because this is the same actor, Jarrus, the prefect, is played by the same actor who played Landru in The Return of the Archons, Charles McCulley. And Sibo is played by Pilar Surratt, who was the mother of Dean Devlin, the producer, writer. He produced Independence Day, among many other films and TV shows. And she was on TV shows like I Spy, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, The Wild Wild West, The FBI, Hawaii 5-0. And Dean Devlin also produced The Librarians.
Right.
And, you know, so he's a really, really great guy.
That is fascinating. And one of the things I find really interesting is Jarrus, right at the beginning, looks at Scotty and says,
"It does not look like a man capable of such an act."
Which I think is really interesting. I think it sets what his behavior is going to be, because he's going to go through some stuff, and yet he continues to be compassionate towards Scotty.
Yes.
And this is what we hear about this culture, that this is unheard of, that there would be a murder on this planet, because they have made this choice to be a certain kind of culture.
Their peace, their turn. They on this planet, again, and it all hit me after Jarrus says the law of Argelius is love.
Yeah.
They turned on, tuned in, and dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a little bit of Haight-Ashbury going on there. Just love.
Well, and what's interesting, again, this is this thing that I've been noticing so much about Star Trek, is when we went to this side of paradise, we didn't like the touchy-feely sort of, you know, we had the Kirk speech about being that we have to strive to the march of the drum thing. There's nothing negative about Argelius. I think the image we have of this planet is, man, these people kind of got some stuff figured out.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
They definitely do.
And the thing we hear is that there's some mystical way of finding out truth. And we hear that Sibo, Jarrus's wife, is a descendant of the ancient priestesses. And he invites everyone to come to their home, and they're going to get to the bottom of this. And immediately Hengist does not like that idea.
And immediately Hengist becomes someone I didn't like.
Yep. That's he's so exactly someone. It's so perfectly done and perfectly cast.
And by the way, I'm still blown away by that. We're going to get to all that stuff with Hengist. Yeah, we'll come back to that.
There's only one way we can find out what it is Mr. Scott cannot remember. Since you find it impossible to let us go back up to our ship, I can beam down a technician with a psychotricorder.
Which was a thing I think we've never heard of before, and we'll never hear again.
You're right, we'll never hear her again.
But apparently we have this device that can say everything that's happened to someone in 24 hours, which is pretty cool. And again, Hengist argues.
Oh, I'd advise against it, Prefect. This is purely an Argelian matter.
And I think this is where we could say, oh, he's the murderer, and he is doing everything he can to put up roadblocks to being exposed. That's perfectly motivatable. It's also perfectly motivatable that some dudes came to his peaceful planet and immediately committed murder, and all the evidence points to this guy, and you don't trust Kirk. That's also perfectly motivatable.
That's absolutely motivatable. You're right.
He calls up to Spock to get someone with a psycho tricorder to beam down.
I was wondering where Spock was during this episode so far. And if you remember, during the conversation we had with Norman Spinrad, the writer of The Doomsday Machine and the last episode of Enterprise Incidents, Norman Spinrad noticed while he was on set that William Shatner was counting lines, because he was feeling like his ego was a little bruised.
Yep.
This was supposed to be his show. Spock was the more popular character. Leonard Nimoy was nominated for an Emmy. Shatner was not. So in order to appease Shatner, Gene Kuhn in particular minimized Spock's appearance to appease Shatner, and that's why we hardly get to see Spock in this episode. You know, we see him now. We see him briefly one more time in Act 2. We really don't get to see him until Act 3 because Kuhn wanted Shatner to feel like,
Here's the star of the show. And you know what? What's so interesting later on in Star Trek is when because they become ensemble shows, and then you're spreading it around. Every week, it's a different person. And now it's really Kirk and Spock.
Yep.
With occasional McCoy.
Yeah.
And in this case, there's some Scotty. But like, we don't have to spread it around to everybody. So, I mean, this makes sense. And then there's a great moment. And they don't do a lot with it, but where the prefect kind of makes a little political hint here.
News of this frightful murder spreading among my people. They're greatly disturbed. I have already heard talk of closing Argelius to space vehicles.
And that is making the political point of, like, you need to treat this with respect.
Absolutely. It's about the economy.
Yeah. Well, and it's about Starfleet, and it's about, you know, we need this place. And what I think he's doing, which I think is really good, he's like, look, I am trusting you with this psycho tricorder thing. I'm giving your guy the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. Don't mess with me, which I like quite a bit.
Yeah.
So our crewman beams down. Kirk orders her to do a 24-hour regressive memory check, and we have a place that she can go to.
Conveniently, it has to be done in private.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
To be done. Wait. And so that's when this occurred to me. Again, another revelation I had watching this with a different set of eyes and ears. Again, you know, we talked at the top of this episode how it's a shift in tones. And, the gothic horror is definitely there. But now there's a little bit of a slasher kick going on, too. We've already had one woman killed.
Yeah.
And now it's like, so for McCoy to say that this test has to be done in private, right? It's basically his way of saying what you never say in a horror movie, which is,
I'll be right back.
I'll be right back.
You know, we just did Scream on the Cinephiles.
Oh,
right?
Did you really?
Yeah, literally, that's the last thing we did.
I'll be right back.
And I love the last moment where Kirk says,
Sonny, cooperate completely with Lieutenant Tracy. Maybe we can clear this thing up.
And doing his performance is so good.
Oh, so good.
I certainly hope so, sir. I can't stand this not knowing.
I felt so bad. Like, when I was a kid watching this episode, I felt so bad for Scotty. And I still feel the empathy. I just think because, you know, like we pointed out on this podcast, that James Doohan's performance is just fantastic. He really did so much with Scotty. And doing this podcast is making me appreciate Doohan's talents so much.
Are you ready, Sipo?
I am ready. May I have the knife, please?
Certainly. Among other gifts, Sipo has the ability to receive impressions from inanimate objects. Do you have it, Captain?
The knife?
No.
The knife has disappeared.
And then you hear a scream. And then we run into the other room. Scotty is passed out. Lieutenant Karen Tracy, who we knew for about 10 whole seconds, is dead.
She's dead, Jim. Just like the other one. Stabbed. Over and over again.
By the way, not a lot of blood. I mean, I know that it's weird because they show the stab marks, but they apparently don't bleed at all.
Yeah, and there's no holes in the uniform either.
Oh, they're not? Yeah. Okay, who killed her?
Okay, well, see, now you have the same... You have the same situation that you had in the teaser.
Right.
So Scotty is passed out with the knife in his hand.
And we're in a locked room, which we later find out maybe someone could have picked that door to come in or maybe not.
Well, if you so wait a minute. Okay. I just realized. Hang on, Steve Morris.
Mm-hmm.
When Karen Tracy beamed down, Hengist was walking out of the room.
Yes.
Okay. And you see him turn back. So he goes, oh, fresh meat, a woman to kill.
Right.
Right? And they nod at each other, and he smiles.
And we can say that he probably stole the knife.
Okay. We could say that he stole the knife.
Mm-hmm.
But who went in the room? What went in the room? And if something went in the room, did something go in the room and kill Karen Tracy? Or did something go in the room and possess Scotty mm-hmm. to kill Karen Tracy?
Or did Hengist, because we said the lock could have been picked, did he go outside, come around to the other side of the building, pick the lock, go in and kill
see what
Tracy?
What I don't think is that Hengist went in the room to kill her.
It seems very unlikely.
Okay. And what I definitely don't think is that Hengist killed Kara, the dancer in the teaser.
So this entity, Red Jack whatever, is living inside Hengist, mm-hmm. right?
It's living inside. Right. He's like, Hengist is the host, but Hengist is aware. I think Hengist is aware. Well, because of the reaction that Hengist actually has in the briefing room when they point everything to Rigel for, like, he gets very
defensive. At that moment, absolutely.
Right.
But is he aware at other... And this is... So, I'm possessing Hengist because mm-hmm. I'm an evil serial killer that never dies and feeds on fear.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to leave Hengist and either take on corporeal form to kill somebody or possess somebody else to kill them.
Right.
What happens to Hengist?
What happens to Hengist? Right. What happens to Hengist when Regic leaves his body?
Yes.
That's a great point. Does he just kind of like fall down, or does he continue on as Hengist? Does Hengist know? Oh, I see. I know what you're getting at. Does Hengist know that Red Chick is inside of him?
Well, and more importantly, is there a Hengist? In other words, was there some kid who was a perfectly ordinary kid, grew up on Rigel IV, totally nice, and got possessed? Or has Hengist, is that actually Jack the Ripper, who's traveled from planet to planet in that body?
Okay, you just asked what happens to Hengist when Red Jack leaves his body. I think because there's proof of this later in the episode, that when Red Jack leaves his body, the body just falls. Like, and maybe he just goes somewhere. Maybe he just goes somewhere where he can fall, like, you know, comfortably and just sort of be inert in an area that no one can see him. Because in the briefing room, after Hengist is outed and tries to, you know, get away, you know, Kirk just punches him once and he dies. And Kirk even says, that's impossible. That's because the entity left.
And he just goes down.
And he just goes down.
I buy that. I think that's logical.
So I think what we're piecing together here, just like we will piece together all of this in the briefing room in Act 3, Steve Morris. So that now we're establishing that that's what happens. And I think that's certainly what happens. You know,
and he may or may not possess other people to do bad stuff too. We don't know.
And if Redrick possessed Scotty for the first two killings, why didn't he possess Scotty when Cebu was killed?
Well, the reason is because the story is not written consistently. And
I could tell you why.
Okay.
Because for the first two times that Scotty was with the women, he was alone.
Mm.
That third time. It was during the seance, and the lights went out, but there were other people in the room. So for whatever reason, maybe Vrecek stayed in the gaseous state to kill Sibo.
Well, and I have another possibility, but let's wait till we get there.
Okay.
But what we know now is that there are two murders where the only really possible suspect in any way to be Scotty.
Right.
And that brings us to the end of Act 1. Act 2, we're back in the prefect's main room. Scotty is out on the couch. He wakes up and just totally disoriented. And Kirk tells him, Lieutenant Tracy's dead and you were found alone in the room.
And again, he doesn't remember.
The reaction, can you imagine? I mean, this happening to you. Two people have been killed and you're there. You got blood on your hands and you have no memory of this.
And he says, I don't know what happened. I must have passed out.
Yeah. And McCoy keeps pushing the head injury thing, which again, I'm like, you're a doctor. It would seem to me like you could examine him.
You know, I got to say, Steve, you're really zeroing in on this thing with McCoy. Like, he's a horrible doctor.
You know what he's really good at? He's really good at finding the cure for the thing that in the last second to save everybody's life.
Yeah.
Great at that.
He's really great at finding a cure for a global pandemic.
Yeah. First aid, not his strong suit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Think, Scotty.
And I love doing again.
Captain, I've been trying. I can't even believe this is really happening.
Heartbreaking.
It really is. And we ask, you know, if there is another door, and they say, yeah, there's a door, but it's been locked for years. And he sends McCoy to check it out because apparently he's got detective skills.
He's a forensic, detective.
In comes Hengist, and now he's brought in the two guys that we had seen at the cafe.
In comes Hengist. So, like you said, where was he?
Well, he did have to go get these guys, though.
But if he had to go get those guys, what came back in to potentially possess Scotty to kill Lieutenant Tracy?
It's possible, but it also means that he was out, because at some point, based on your theory, he collapsed.
Yeah.
So that had to be related before, or it had to be before he went to get the guys.
Right. Interesting.
Not this a lot of time to collapse.
Really interesting, yes.
Prefect, both of these men were at the cafe the night of the murder.
Where have they been during the past few minutes?
Captain, if you don't mind, please.
There's been another murder, Hengist. One of my crew.
We start asking some questions of these guys that they're with. And the first one, I guess his name is Morla?
Played by Charles Dierkop. And being Steve Morris, the classic cinema fan that you are, doing the Cinephiles, I know that you did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
We have not done Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid yet.
Well, boy, is that...
It's certainly on our list.
That is a big, fat movie that you guys, you and John Rocha, have to do. What about The Sting? Did you guys do The Sting?
Yeah, we've not done The Sting either.
Okay, maybe that's why you didn't recognize this guy, because Charles Dierkop was in both of those movies, and he's so recognizable.
I could totally picture him in The Sting, because he's the henchman for Robert Shaw.
Right, and he's sitting behind Newman in the card game.
In the card game.
Yep.
One of the greatest scenes of all time, by the way.
I completely agree. That just talking about that scene that makes me want to rewatch the whole movie.
It's when I teach in film school.
Oh, it's such a great scene.
So much going on.
Awesome. But he was also on TV in Batman, Adam 12, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, Policewoman, to name a few. And with him, because there's two people there, is Tark. Tark is played by Joseph Bernard, who on TV was on shows like The Untouchables, Naked City, and Mission Impossible. And in film, he was in Ice Station Zebra and Judgment at Nuremberg with
William Shatner.
William Shatner.
You were a musician at the cafe. You played for the murdered girl.
Since she was a little girl, she danced for me. She was my daughter.
And this is where we find out some stuff. Because Kirk starts to, this is the detective show. He is now Columbo.
Yes, he is.
Asking some questions. And what we find out is that Morla was in love with Kara, the dancer, and that he left because he was jealous. And when we hear the word jealous, there is a music sting, because jealousy on this planet is a hugely forbidden emotion.
Yep.
Because it is so dangerous, which makes sense. You're on a hedonistic planet. Jealousy is going to be a problem.
I know it was wrong, Prefect, but I just couldn't help myself. I loved her.
Every time he says that, when I watch this episode, I felt like he was admitting guilt that he actually did kill her. When he says, "I knew,"
I couldn't
help
myself.
Yeah. When he says, "I knew it was wrong, I couldn't help myself," I said, "Oh, so I guess he killed her." But then you realize, no, he was saying, "I knew it was wrong to be jealous."
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting, and again, it goes to something we kind of talked about. It's not that these are aliens as much as this is a culture that it's not that we don't have jealousy. It's that we have a culture that doesn't value, that doesn't want us to be jealous, that tries to repress that particular emotion. And McCoy comes back in and says, "I don't know if that lock was picked. Can't tell."
McCoy. Poor McCoy.
I love him.
I know.
You know what's funny, and I hope that people listening enjoy this, that I'm not criticizing the show. I just think it's funny.
Listen, I think it's funny too, because you know what? You were establishing, just like we have done with Kirk and Spock, we are establishing a character trait in McCoy.
Captain, may I continue with the questions, please?
Well, get on with it, man. Just don't stand there.
And he's getting desperate.
Yeah.
He's getting desperate. He wants to save. And the prefect calls him out on that. Yeah. He said, you're trying to save your friend. He goes, well, of course I'm trying to save my friend.
If he's innocent and he hasn't been proven guilty.
Need I remind you of the circumstances, Captain? In both cases, your friend Scott was discovered over the body and later claimed to remember nothing.
And SIBO is ready. And then this makes no sense at all. We're going to sit down and have our seance-y kind of thing. And Kirk says, on one condition, that the room be sealed so no one could leave or enter while the ceremony's going on. And I love that the prefect has buttons, and on music stings, we close all the doors.
Room is sealed.
Very cool. But like, why? Why did you have to seal the room?
Well, I just thought maybe they don't want to take any chances that the killer could come in and kill them. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
It's totally, all writers do this
sometimes. It's dramatic.
Is that sometimes you have a character say a thing because you want to seal the room. So you don't really have a reason, but that makes this more, because the reason that it should be a sealed room is that nobody else could possibly kill SIBO except one of the, it's a closed room mystery. That's why you do it.
Captain. You mean my neck is going to have to depend on some spooky mumbo-jumbo?
And we get a call from Spock, and Spock says, hey, I wouldn't risk a dude's life on on this Argelian empathic thing. And Kirk's like, I got no choice.
Right, this is Kirk the diplomat.
Yeah, and now we're in the ceremony.
Let us begin. Let the circle not be broken.
I love the scene.
And they start with a top-down. Like a straight-up top-down shot onto the table. It's great.
And I gotta say, for Joseph Pevney, who... Well, directed this episode on schedule 6 days. That was a complex shot to do.
Yeah.
And he could have just not done that shot, done something much more simple that would have saved time, but he still got that great shot. It's a great establishing shot. Obviously, the lighting in the scene, the camera going around the fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a well-directed scene. I've always had this image. Whenever I think of the episode Wolf in the Fold, the image that I think of is going around the table, the seance scene.
I think it's great, and I think she's great.
Yeah.
You know, this is all she has to do in the whole episode, and she's got this really intense monologue, and she nails it.
There is evil here. Monstrous, terrible evil. Consuming hunger. Hatred of all that lives. Hatred of women. A hunger that never dies.
And then we see the flame start to go out, and it gets darker.
It gets darker, and you start to hear that she's saying there is evil here. It has a name.
It has a name. Baradis, Kessler, Rejek, devouring all life, all light, a hunger that will never die. Rejek! Rejek!
And then the lights go out, and we know what's going to happen next.
The lights come up, and she is dead.
And Scotty's holding her.
When he lets her go, the knife is in her back.
Yep. And then we cut, and it's later, and Kirk and McCoy are facing Scotty, and Hengist and the prefect are in the background. He's obviously in shock because his wife was just murdered in front of him, which, by the way, I don't think we deal with that enough. Like, he's pretty calm.
Yeah, for the rest of the episode. The
maybe
yeah,
Argelians yeah. just deal with tragedy well, but like, that seems like a lot.
Three murders. And Scotty, the only possible answer each time.
Well, I don't care what the circumstances indicate, Jim. Scotty simply could not have done it.
Normally, no.
And then we go back to, but that blow to the head, it's all why it wasn't established well. Like, even if you had seen, like, if Scotty went to take a drink and his hand shook, even a little thing like that would be better than just repeating this blow to the head thing.
But up to this point, like, McCoy was the one who was more suspicious of Scotty, and Kirk was being more defensive of him. And now you have McCoy being defensive that could have been that blow to the head. And Kirk is kind of, you know, pressing forward. He's still trying to defend his friend, but, I mean, the evidence is pretty damning.
I agree with you, Captain. I'm perfectly satisfied Mr. Scott is guilty.
But not responsible.
That is unproven, sir.
I love Hengist. I think he's a great character. I love the way he speaks. And yes, I don't like him. But I, as a character in a show, I love him.
It's a good character.
Yeah.
But you don't like the guy.
Yeah. It's like Snape is a great villain, or, you know, I just choose true Alan Rickman ones, but, you know, Hans and Die Hard, you know, there are villains who, or Hannibal Lecter, they're horrible people, but you love them.
You like, yeah. Love to hate them.
Mr. Scott. Sir, I swear to you, I did not kill your wife or the other ladies.
By your own admission, you don't know whether you did or didn't.
And again, Kirk is pushing the Enterprise. We got some technology. We can find out what happened.
There would be no room for doubt. We would know. And after all, that's what we're after, isn't it, Prefect? To know.
You, sir, claim to remember nothing about the murders.
Aye.
If this is so, you may have killed without knowing it.
So I wish they resolved more of Scotty's character. The show goes a different direction, but we don't get kind of a resolution of him because he's on the tranquilizers at the end. So,
So
he's just
right.
happy. We don't really have like,
he's off the hook. He's happy. He's, you know, he's stoned. By the way, we have not discussed Steve who killed Sibo.
Right. Well, and this is the thing. Scotty says he felt something, but that might not. I mean, who knows? I mean, like, but this seems the biggest example of something became solid and killed Sibo.
Okay, and also this is the only time that Scotty is conscious.
Right, which is why I lean towards the possessed Scotty thing because...
For the first two.
Because something's clearly different for this one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, based on that, I absolutely am leaning towards Scotty being possessed by Rejek for the first two kills.
And he who is guilty will face the ancient penalties, barbaric and horrible though they may be. The ancient penalty for murder was death by slow torture. Do you understand that, Mr. Scott?
I understand.
And that brings us to the end of Act Two.
Act three, we're on the Enterprise. We're in the briefing room. We kind of set up the trial thing that there's this thing you put your hand on, and it's going to tell you if you're lying. The computer will report.
Which we saw in court-martial.
In court-martial. And we call Scott to the stand. I love that they all put their little disc into the, you know, their little card into the computer. I love little bits of sciencey stuff like that.
Subject's present physical condition.
Subject recently received severe blow on skull. Some peripheral abnormalities.
Sufficient abnormalities to account for periods of functional amnesia.
Negative.
And there is a music sting.
Dun-dun.
Captain, I don't see how that can be.
And I'm like, aren't you a doctor? I'll stop it.
Man, McCoy really good. Just does not earn his title in this episode.
Unless Scott is lying about his loss of memory.
I'm not lying, Captain. I don't remember a thing about the first two murders.
By the way, I don't understand why he hasn't said, but I do remember the third one. And then he tells a story.
I heard the poor lady scream, and I was near the head of the table anyway. I went toward her, but there was something in my way.
Something? You mean someone?
No, Captain. Something.
I love this line.
Cold it was, like a stinking draft out of a slaughterhouse, but it wasn't really there.
And the computer says, subject relaying accurate account, no physiological changes.
Well, you know, when we were talking about the cast...
Yeah.
For this episode and the guest stars in this episode. One guest star I forgot to mention is Majel Barrett, who is prominently featured in this episode as the voice of the ship's computer, because the ship's computer is heard a lot during this act.
Yeah. And I love how she plays it. I think she does. I mean, not that it's a super challenging role or anything. I don't mean it like that. But I do think that she establishes a character for that computer.
And I also think that the computer's recounts of, especially as it gets further into this act, it gets pretty chilling.
All right. Let's hit it on the head. Scotty, did you kill Sebo?
No, Captain. That I'm sure of.
He's been saying that right along. Means no more now than it did before.
Getting more and more suspicious. More and more unlikable.
I totally disagree.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's perfectly good reasons to not trust Scotty. Like the murderer, it's a closed door murders. He's the main suspect every time. He's locked in, or only person in a room for one of them.
You
see him holding the body, and the guy says, "I don't remember killing him." If you're a cop, wouldn't you say, "Come on, you've been saying that all the time."
Yeah, you know what? You're right. Yeah. That third killing.
Yeah.
The light goes on, and he's standing there holding her body.
And it's a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
You know?
You're right.
Like, and the thing too is, now his buddies bring him to the ship and say, "No, we've proven he's not lying." Would you believe them?
No.
Well, and this is where I go. This is why the who is Hengist? Is Hengist actually just Hengist most of the time and being the host for this entity? Or is this 100% Jack the Ripper controlling and doing everything he does?
Well, and again, because we see what happens when the entity leaves Hengist's body, that the body becomes inert.
Yes.
I think that it's Jack the Ripper, it's Red Jack, but acting out an alias, so to speak. That's what I'm leaning towards.
I think it's a really good point about the way he passes out and comes back too. That's what I hadn't thought about.
See?
No, I think that's a really good point.
Scotty, lie to me. How old are you?
22, sir.
Inaccurate.
Yeah, I love the thing lights up. There's a good sound effect.
But I remind you, we found Mr. Scott holding her in his arms. The knife...
And I love this is another little good bit of writing.
I'm sorry, sir, but I must. The knife still in her back and blood on his hands.
And here's the thing. Kirk knows now that Scotty's not lying because Kirk knows that equipment does work.
Oh, right. That's why he wanted to beam up to the Enterprise in the first place.
Did you kill Tara?
I don't remember.
Did you kill Lieutenant Tracy?
I don't remember.
Okay, now here's you brought up a... In Act Two, you said, "Oh, now Kirk is acting like Columbo."
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So here we are in Act Three, and it occurred to me watching this episode, boy, William Shatner is really, really good in this episode, and particularly in this scene in Act Three. Shatner is fantastic. He is absolutely in control of that scene, and it occurred to me, of course, he is. In 1957, he was in the two-part television movie, The Defender, which was a courtroom drama. Much, much later, in the 21st century, he was on Boston Legal.
Right. Well, Andy's
which was a courtroom drama.
Andy's
and he was in Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yes, although he's not in the court in
right.
that. He's also T.J. Hooker. He's been a detective going around asking questions.
He is great in this scene. This is where he earned it.
Here's what I thought you were going to say when you mentioned Columbo, which I just remembered. He's the bad guy in an episode of Columbo.
Yeah, he is in it. He's in an episode of Columbo.
Yeah. Now it's Morla's turn.
Where were you at the time that Kara was murdered?
And I think we can kind of move through this maybe a little more quickly, is that he says he was angry. He says he didn't do it. And there's this great moment, which is classic sort of courtroom drama.
I loved her, and she loved me.
That's not true. He might think she loved him, but she didn't.
This is classic in Agatha Christie and Hercule Poirot has all the suspects in one room kind of scene.
Yeah, yeah. This is totally murder Shatner wrote.
Yeah, exactly. And then Kirk has this thought.
Mr. Spock, maybe we're going about it the wrong way. Let's assume that Sebo was a sensitive, that she did sense something evil.
And Spock goes, it's possible. This Argelian sensitivity really exists.
My poor Sebo's talent was genuine, gentlemen. What she told you was true.
And then we go over, what did she exactly say?
Monstrous evil, ancient terror.
That devours all life and light.
And then we remember those weird words. What were those words, Scott?
Baratus, Kessla, Regic.
It could be meaningless, but let's check it out. And we ask the computer, is Regic a word? And the computer says, no.
It's not. But then it says, check all other banks.
Yeah.
And then, bingo, bullseye.
Earth, 19th century, nicknamed for mass murderer of women. Other Earth synonym, Jack the Ripper.
Dun, dun, dun.
Jack the Ripper. Like, I still think that revelation, it's still like a great, oh, wow, that's wild that Jack the Ripper is way out in space in the 23rd century.
I don't know this for sure, but I suspect this is the first time I ever heard of Jack the Ripper.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was probably 7 when I first saw this episode. I don't know where else I would have heard of it.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
That's a really great point. Yeah, I probably knew who Jack the Ripper was when I watched Star Trek.
And now we get into this conversation of, well, it can't have lived that long because a man can't live that long, but other things maybe live that long.
Humans and humanoids make up only a small percentage of the life forms we know of. There are entities possessed of extremely long lifespans, virtually immortal.
You know what I thought? It's like we literally just met one. Is we just met Apollo.
Yeah, that's right.
He is a guy they know had been around for at least 5,000 years. And not only that, they also know that to some degree, he fed on worship.
Oh, that's right.
But Sebo said that it feeds on death.
And again, this is something that it was a very influential sentence to me.
In the strict scientific sense, Doctor, we all feed on death, even vegetarians.
I've remembered that forever. I used to write a blog. And I wrote a whole blog, and I didn't know that it was totally based on that line, but just on the relationship of what we eat and death and life. And I wrote, literally, we feed on death, not knowing I was actually quoting Star Trek.
You know, here you have, we're establishing that this gaseous presence is the embodiment of Jack the Ripper and all its various names as it went out into space.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, so you have this entity that feeds on fear.
Yes.
When we get to the end of this episode and this entity is beamed out into space, did a mutation of that entity come back to haunt the Enterprise?
In Day of the Dove.
In Day of the Dove.
I think it's its twin brother because it feeds on it. Because Day of the Dove, it doesn't feed on fear. It feeds on anger and hate.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
So I think they're like the same species. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
That's what I've always thought. Obviously, I have no evidence of this at all, but I've always connected the two.
I never connected the two until I just watched Wolf in the Fold this time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you remember when we were talking about Apollo and I brought up Wolf in the Fold and Day of the Dove. Like, to me, like they've always been connected in my brain.
Interesting. Yeah.
Deriving sustenance from emotion is not unknown in the galaxy, and fear is among the strongest and most violent of the emotions.
And Hengist has had enough.
Surely, Prefect, this has gone far enough. Someone, some man, has killed three women. We have the prime suspect in our hands. Are we going to let him go and start chasing ghosts?
No, Mr. Hengist, not ghosts. Possibly not human, but not ghosts.
And we ask the computer for examples, and we hear, yes, there's some creature that feeds on love. They ask, like, what form would that kind of thing take? And the computer, these computers seems to know everything. Very smart computers.
Yep.
Entity would exist without form in conventional sense. Most probable, mass of energy.
Which also, by the way, we've met beings of pure energy already.
Yes, we have.
In the show. And that's where, this is where continuity, I think, would have helped them a little bit. Because although I actually really like Kirk's line where they talk about this thing called a Miletus.
I've seen the Miletus myself. In its natural state, it's gaseous. When it's at rest, it's solid.
I think he does a great job delivering that line, but he also could have said, we were on a planet called Organia where the entire population were made out of energy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And they did that a little couple of times where they specifically, yeah, like by any other name, they did it. That, yeah, which survives, they did it. You're right. They could have absolutely, yeah, done that.
Well, this is fantasy. We all know the murderer is sitting right here with us. I mean, you're trying to cloud the issue.
Which, again, this is totally motivatable. If someone like you is like, that dude killed her. Mm. I was in the room. He had blood on his hands. You're trying to tell me some ancient fear-eating thing is what did it? Come on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're really actually being very generous to Scotty by even doing this in the first place.
The thing I picked up on this time, which I think is well-written and does make sense, is that Jarrus loves and trusts his wife. His wife said there was an ancient evil. That's the best evidence for him.
Right. Like, that's the best evidence for him to think maybe Scotty didn't do it.
Creature without form that feeds on horror and fear that must assume a physical shape to kill.
And I suspect preys on women because women are more easily and more deeply terrified, generating more sheer horror than the male of the species.
That line has not aged well at all. What a sexist comment, Mr. Spock.
So first of all, I want everyone listening to go put the episode back on and watch the lieutenant or whatever it is who's like transcribing this event. Watch her face when Spock says that line. She is having none of it. It is so, and I love that just this, and I don't know if the director told her to do that or if she is like, I got this little part, but I'm not going to let that line go by without giving a look.
But Spock, with some of his comments, remember in The Side of Paradise, he goes, I've never understood the female capacity to avoid the direct answer to a question.
Yes. So it's clearly Spock is a bit of a sexist.
Yeah, he is.
And what's interesting, you know what? Okay, this is a total digression. What just occurred to me?
What?
Is I've been thinking a lot about Spock's parentage, about parents, and about Sarek lately.
Yeah,
particularly because we're coming up on
Journey to Babel.
On Journey to Babel, and the thing I suddenly went is like, how respectful was Sarek to his wife?
Interesting question. Well, I think from what we see,
he's very respectful.
But
he doesn't like humans. He doesn't respect humans. Let's table this whole thing. But I just suddenly went, how did Spock get to be so sexist? And I was thinking about Sarek and wondering about that a little bit.
But I do think that there is a little bit about Sarek that's, I don't know if it's sexist, but he sees, well, maybe it is sexist, that he's, you know, men are men and women are women.
Tiny preview. I've been having a lot of thoughts about Sarek and Journey to Babel. So
we're going to have a good conversation when we get to that.
There's going to be a lot of stuff there. But let's also just officially explode this ridiculous idea that women are more easily frightened than men.
I mean, yeah.
Come on.
Delete that line.
That is just like everybody gets frightened.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Everybody.
Everybody.
There's no difference.
Women do not get frightened more than men.
There are plenty of brave women and plenty of scared dudes.
And that line, that's a line that always...
Yeah.
Struck me as like, really, Spock?
Yeah.
Come on.
And now we go, give us the list of unresolved mass murderers. And by the way, this list is so short because they just, it's like we could list they didn't mention Ted Bundy and Ed Gein and like, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of these people.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But they go through a few, and like in all Star Trek, we start on Earth and then we move off Earth onto different planets. And I love the repetition of the word
knifed to death.
Knifed to death.
Yes. Yeah. It's chilling.
It is. It really is.
Yeah.
And all of those planets are in a direct line from Earth to Argelius.
When man moved out into the galaxy, that thing must have moved with him.
Wow.
Now let's ask about the other names. Kesla is related to a mass murder of women on Deneb 2, and Baratus is about a mass murder of women on Rigel 4 that occurred one solar year ago. And I love the turn to Hengist.
You come from Rigel 4.
Well, many people do. It's not a crime.
What's so great is that in this case, we have hated him the whole show. And again, I have no memory of seeing this the first time, but I am sure when you saw it the first time and you heard Rigel 4, if you remembered that line from the beginning,
I didn't.
You just go, he's the man, it's him.
Yeah, that's great.
So it's what's so funny. There are problems in this show, but the things that are good in this show are really, really good.
Would you mind taking the stand, Mr. Hengist?
Oh, that is like, boys, he's so not taking the stand.
Prefect, this has gone far enough. I will not take the stand.
I love his voice. I love the way he delivers the lines. It's just so great.
An entity which feeds on fear and terror would find a perfect hunting ground on Argelius, a planet without violence, where the inhabitants are as peaceful as sheep.
The entity would be as a hungry wolf in that fold, which of course makes me think of Duran Duran.
Never made me
hungry
thought
like
of that.
The wolf.
But it's just, to me, it's just another example of like, don't say the title in the show.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't, it's not necessary.
But it is a great title.
It's a good title. Totally.
Gentlemen, I know something of the law. You're engaging in sheer speculation.
And now, I don't know why they say let's show the murder weapon, but we show on the monitor hands showing the murder weapon.
Yeah, turning the murder weapon, right.
Point of origin.
Artifact produced by hill people of Argus River region, planet Rigel 4.
Da, da, da.
Which, by the way, I think, Hengist, you're a dumb murderer. Like, why?
Right. Why would you bring a weapon from Rigel 4?
You're the only dude from Rigel 4 on this planet.
And they don't have any sharp objects on Argelius 2?
Well, and it's like, it's not like it's a knife from 1895 London. You know, so you haven't been bringing it from everywhere.
And so Hengist gets up.
And transforms into a huge stuntman.
A huge stuntman with a horrible ball cap.
Yeah, terrible. And does a big kick in the chest on Kirk.
And by the way, that is Shatner.
It totally Shatner.
Totally Shatner. And Shatner goes back to him, knocks it, punches him, one punch in the face.
One punch out.
And he is not only knocked out.
Yeah.
But as McCoy... As McCoy discovers, he's dead, Jim.
He's dead.
But McCoy doesn't do any CPR. No. He doesn't try to revive him.
I'm going to ask this question of our listeners. Should we stop? I mean, it's like, answer the question, go to Facebook page. Are you tired of this joke?
Why doesn't McCoy check him out? He'll try to revive him.
CPR.
You know, pound his chest.
You're on the Enterprise with the top of the line medical equipment.
He's dead, Jim.
He's dead. That's it.
McCoy is a horrible doctor.
It's terrible. What's really funny is it took me until doing this show for me to notice this.
But it took me until doing this show for me to realize you're right.
But that's not the end, because then what happens, and I love the lights go out, the lights fade down, and we hear this maniacal laughing that's echoing across the ship.
The computer will not respond to these controls. The entity is unquestionably controlling it.
And the computer controls the ship.
That brings us to the end of Act 3. Before we move on to Act 4,
yes,
I just want to pose a challenge to one of our listeners. I dare somebody to take the audio, the Regic, Regic, Regic. I dare a listener to take the audio of Hengist and superimpose the Regic, Regic, Regic over Piglet.
That's great. You know, because the thought that occurred to me, I think your idea is better. I was like, you could totally make some... like remix auto-tuned song out of this laughter and regicness that's coming out of the computer.
But just, you know, some surprise, I don't know, maybe somebody's already done it because everything is on YouTube.
Right.
But just, you know, clips of Piglet, you know, acting really weird with the voice of Regic.
I had a question for you.
Yes.
So you, because of doing this show, I learned from you that in Court Martial, there was a whole plot of battling the ship's computer.
That's right.
That had become sentient. I'm wondering if some of that's how they got to this.
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. You know, by that point, Kuhn was the showrunner for Star Trek. So it's possible that they did save that element. But no, wait a minute.
Well, because what was wrong with it in Court Martial that I remember that you had said was the Enterprise is Kirk's love. We don't want to make that bad.
Right, right, that's right.
But this is a way to do it without violating that principle.
Well, you know, in the earlier versions for Court Martial, you know, the computer, the Enterprise, was more of a almost like a sentient being that was like jealous of Kirk and right. like you know set right, out right, to right. frame Kirk. But that was the Enterprise computer. This is now not the Enterprise right. computer, or it is. It's just
taken over
by Regic, yeah. right?
Regic! We're back in Act Four with the maniacal laughing continuing and echoing across the room. For some reason that makes no sense to me at all, McCoy and Scotty pick up the dead body and sit him in a chair.
Yeah. Why do that?
It's a weird thing to do with a corpse.
Well, when the original versions, the earlier versions of the story, Regic, Jack the Ripper, takes over the Enterprise much earlier and uses the mechanisms to frighten and even kill some of the crew members.
Mm. Then they look at the computer and the monitor is showing crazy visuals, and I had to go like, oh, wow, Dave Rossi, and they did a really good job redoing these effects. They look really cool. And then I looked and was like, no, that's actually the original effects. They're cool.
Yeah, they're cool.
That thing can control the entire operation of the ship, including the life support systems.
You mean it could kill us all?
Indeed, it will try, but not immediately. We know it feeds on fear and terror. Surely it will try to breed fear and terror before it kills.
Which actually, as you say, they were going to have this longer. I actually think that would have been really interesting.
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they made the wrong choice, but I think there was a lot of interesting things they could have done.
Because I think it's really interesting when they turn the Enterprise into a hell ship.
Yeah.
Like what they did in Charlie X.
Yeah.
You know, that was, you know, like...
And Day of the Dove, too, in a different way.
Oh, for sure, Day of the Dove.
All hands, this is the captain. Stay at your posts. Remain calm.
And then, but then I love that he immediately goes to Bones. It's like,
what's the sedative situation?
If Bones basically says, I have some really good drugs.
Basically, yeah.
This is going to be, it's good stuff. Yeah.
He's a horrible doctor, but he's possessing some good stuff.
So Kirk's like, good, drug us all up.
Okay, no, wait a minute.
Yeah.
As soon as Kirk tells McCoy to get this tranquilizer,
yeah.
Spock and Kirk walk out of the briefing room.
Yes.
And they're in the corridors.
Yes.
And as they're walking by other crew members, they already have big smiles on their faces.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know if you noticed.
I didn't.
So, yeah, like if you see in the behind them, the crew members are walking by each other and they're like smiling at each other, big, big smiles. So I'm wondering, like,
was there a cut scene or was something moved?
I don't know. But the way it's cut, it's like, wow, McCoy got those drugs out there really, really freaking fast.
Yeah, apparently. And this is where we hear something about...
Well, aren't there certain mathematical problems which simply cannot be solved?
Indeed. If we could focus the attention of the computer on one of them,
that ought to do it.
And that's the beginning of the idea. And then they step into a lift, and there's a moment that maybe you can explain to me.
Yeah.
Was he goes, Spock...
Okay, yes, I can explain it to you.
Okay.
So, just like I mentioned how Regic was supposed to possess the Enterprise computers earlier and use the mechanisms to frighten and even kill some of the crew members. Well, that is what Regic is doing right now with the Enterprise. So Kirk gets into the turbo lift, and as Spock is getting into the turbo lift, the doors shut early
and almost
cut Spock right in half.
That's what I assumed it was, but it doesn't work. It's not there.
It doesn't work because they were supposed to film a POV, point of view of Nimoy almost getting chopped in half by the doors, but they didn't film it. And that's why the way it's actually cut, it's like, why is Kirk screaming out for Spock?
And they probably didn't have any coverage, so there wasn't really a way to get them into the turbo lift.
Exactly.
So they were stuck with it.
Yeah, they didn't shoot it.
And then they're in free fall.
Free fall. Out of control. Put it on manual.
Whatever that means. But this is where I go, hey, I wish there were some more of these things. I think they would be fun of this ship trying to kill them.
Captain, the life support system override jammed.
All right. Man your station, Mr. Sulu.
Aye, sir.
What's interesting to me is that Kirk does not tell Sulu what's going on. on purpose.
Why?
Why does he not tell him?
Yeah.
I think because he doesn't want to scare anybody, because he clearly doesn't tell him. Because Sulu asks.
Yeah. Right.
He doesn't say, hey, by the way, an eternal serial killer has taken over the ship and is going to slowly kill us to death and scare the crap out of us.
Right, right.
He says, mind your helm. You know?
Right, right.
Captain Kirk. Captain, you're wasting your time.
I love the sound of his voice and, you know, just yelling and laughing and being maniacal.
When I was a kid, this scared me.
The sound design's really good.
Absolutely. Yeah. The mixing of the sound.
The distortion, yep. And lots of reverb. Mm-hmm. And it sounds, they might be pitch shifting it, which what you used to do, which we have computers that do all sorts of fancier stuff now, but slowing up and speeding down the tape on the reel-to-reel that sort of stretches things out and that lowers the tone when you slow it down. It raises it up when you speed it up. I think they're doing a little bit of that and also doing reverb and other stuff to it too.
You and all aboard your ship are about to die!
This is the first time I heard a malfunction threaten us.
Man your post, Mr. Sulu.
And then in comes the nurse with the drugs. And Kirk says, all right, you know, trank everybody, including yourself.
I am without ending. I have existed from the dawn of time, and I shall live beyond its end.
And now everyone on the bridge is kind of having a good time.
Everyone's having a good time.
And this time I do not need a knife.
And then Sulu looks up. He has not had the tranquilizer yet.
Captain?
And then he gets a tranquilizer.
Whoever he is. He sure talks gloomy.
He's great.
So, and this is what I went, it's like, how many times have we seen Sulu had the happy juice? Because it's Return of the Archons. It's This Side of Paradise.
The Naked Time.
Naked Time. It's a little different, but still.
Yep.
And one of the things I think is like, you know what? George Takei has a beautiful smile.
Yeah, he does.
When he smiles, it just totally lights up the room.
Yeah, he has a big, 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 beautiful smile.
And I love that he starts to get up and Kirk's like, man, your post.
Yeah, yeah. He just gently
okay, really, really messed up guy.
Mind your helmet.
Fly the Enterprise.
Yep.
Yeah.
Drunk.
Yeah, it's like you totally see them getting pulled over and Sulu having to walk a line, you know. You know, flying warp 8 in circles. He's just like,
with an arm full of this stuff, I wouldn't be afraid of a supernova.
And now we're going to take on the computer.
Yeah.
Not our most brilliant computer jujitsu, but...
It works for 1967.
Computer, this is a Class A compulsory directive.
Compute to the last digit the value of pi.
No.
And Spock then explains, which I think I'm sure is the first time I heard of pi. I didn't have the geometry yet.
I heard of Jack the Ripper and pi.
As we know, the value of pi is a transcendental figure without resolution. The computer banks will work on this problem to the exclusion of all else until we order it to stop.
And I think about it, it's like I literally went on the internet to look and, you know, looked up 3.141592653358972386464282838. You know, like, this is so easy for a computer, like, to just continually compute pi today. Not really. I mean, it would never get to the end, but it's not like it would destroy my iPhone to tell to calculate pi.
Yes, that should keep that thing busy for a while.
We get back to the briefing room. And we see Happy Scotty. He's doing great. And he asks McCoy how things are going. It's like the last four people are Jarvis, himself, Kirk, and Spock. And Jarvis is very, very conspicuously facing away from us.
Right, his back is to the camera. Yeah.
We hear the laughter, and then the lighting changes, and then the laughter stops. And we got complete computer control back. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Bones, what would happen if that thing entered a tranquilized body?
Might take up knitting.
Better give yourself a shot, Doc.
No, I don't think so. I think I ought to stay clear.
Do as I say.
And he gives himself a shot. And man, these drugs work fast.
Yeah, they work fast.
They really do. And then they go, okay, Jarvis, it's your turn. And now he is Red Jack.
No, kill you all, die, make you suffer.
He starts struggling with Kirk. And here comes the FSMP, the famous Spock neck pinch.
I think, by the way, they might have done something weird with Jarvis's voice. Because it sounds different, and I almost wonder if they had the actor who plays Hengis say these lines and Jarvis say these lines, and they doubled them. and put reverb on him because his voice sounds weird.
No, no, kill you all, die, make you suffer.
It does sound different for sure.
And now as soon as Jarsh goes down, Hengist jumps up.
So let's come back to your initial theories about Rejek. You're seeing that once Rejek leaves a possessed body, the body becomes inert. Well, certainly you're seeing it, you know, like when it goes back into Hengist, Hengist comes back to life, so to speak. So I think this really does kind of support the theory that we've been developing that Rejek is Hengist. That Rejek is Hengist. And that when Rejek leaves his body becomes inert. And that's why it was able to enter the room during the seance and kill Sibo.
I think, and of course, this is all speculation. And
sure, of course
and,
it
and,
is.
And if we talk to the people who made this show, they would be like, what are you talking about?
What are you talking
but
about?
I think because Rejek has been in Hengist for a really long time, it's different from him. He jumps in and out of Scotty. Scotty just doesn't remember. He jumps in and out of Jarsh. Jarsh probably doesn't remember this one moment, but he's not collapsing.
Right.
But the bonding with Hengist is way deeper because he's been in his body for so long. Mm. And what I wonder about is like, was there, when did he, because it could be that this is what he looked like when he was Jack the Ripper, that this body has been forever. Or it could be that he possessed someone on Rigel 4 when he was 16 and has been taking over him since then.
There you go.
Like, we don't know.
We don't know.
But we're back to our bald-capped stuntman.
Yeah, he's suddenly grown like a whole foot.
He's like put 30, 40 pounds on him. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And he grabs whatever the lieutenant is.
Everybody keep back. I'll kill her. I'll kill her. Keep back.
Drunk McCoy goes.
Yeah, he goes, you better be careful. You're going to hurt somebody with that thing. And by the way, so this episode has shifted. The tone of this episode,
totally.
like it went from first of all, you know, the last act was a courtroom drama, then it's horror again,
right?
And now it's a comedy.
It's totally silly and fun.
It works. It's a shift in tones that works. And you know what? I was thinking about this episode last night because last night I watched my favorite horror movie of all time, which is An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, I knew that's one you love.
That
I haven't seen it in a while.
Have you guys done that on Cinephiles?
No,
boy, you would. You've got to have Scott Mance back as a guest on the Cinephiles.
We get this so often on Cinephiles. It's like, I can't believe you haven't done. And it's like, yeah, we haven't done most of the movies.
Yeah. You guys have only been around for years.
We have 250 episodes. Many of them are two-parters. So, you know, we've done 150 movies or so.
But An American Werewolf in London, the reason why it's my favorite scary movie is because it is a love story. Mm-hmm. It is a comedy. But when it is...
When it's scary, it's real scary.
When it's scary, it's really friggin' scary.
Yeah.
So, like, all the stuff in the... Like, when he's in the park and he's naked and he steals the balloons and the jacket. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the love story when they go back to her place. But the scene when he turns into the werewolf...
It scared the crap out of me the first time I saw it.
When he turns into that... First of all, the transformation alone.
Yeah.
But even after the transformation... When they're going to the friend's house and they get killed in the yard, and then the homeless people by the docks, and I think that the scariest scene in the whole movie is the scene in the tube when the guy's running through Tottenham Court Road. But that is genuinely scary, and then it goes back to being a comedy again.
Yep.
And I was thinking about An American Werewolf in London when I was thinking about Wolf in the Fold. Because just like An American Werewolf in London is a seamless shift in tones that totally works, so is Wolf in the Fold. It is a seamless shift in tones that totally works.
To me, the moment that the tone shifts is clearly when Sulu smiles. Like when he gets the shot, that's when it becomes a comedy. Because somebody says, that guy sure talks gloomy, where it's funny.
And now you're into this funny, fun part of the episode.
And Kirk, after McCoy distracts Hengist, does a great flip.
And when McCoy shoots Hengist with the tranquilizer, he goes, "You suffered!" And he starts laughing.
Die, 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 everybody die.
Die, 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 everybody die was quoted among my friends over and over again. It's just like in random moments, just die, 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 everybody die.
When you said at the top of this episode that you quoted this episode so many times, I'm like, what does he quote?
Well, there's another
one. That's the line?
No, there's another line that is absolutely one that was quoted. We'll get to it. We're almost there.
Oh, okay.
We're almost there.
And Kirk picks him up, and he's walking him down the corridor towards the transporter. Not even running, like walk.
We go into the transporter room where there's also a drugged out Kyle.
Kyle. Poor Kyle.
And they put him on the platform and say,
deep space. Full power. Widest angle of dispersion. Maintain.
Get excited, Captain. I'll do it.
And Spock goes over to the transporter
room. Pushes him away.
Pushes him out of the way. They beam Hengist out into space. They beam Redrick out into space. Something that they're going to do again in one more episode with another antagonist.
And then McCoy and Scotty enter, just beaming.
No pun intended.
Yeah. it's funny.
Well, the thing can't die.
Possibly, Doctor. Its consciousness may continue for some time, consisting of billions of separate bits of energy floating forever in space. Powerless.
But it will die finally.
Maybe not. Well, wouldn't that have been
a
great establishment of continuity to have it return in a mutated form
as the
entity in Day of the Dove?
Well, and I go, like, you don't know what's going to happen to this thing. Yeah. Like, you don't know anything about this thing.
Right, they're just speculating.
You're just making stuff up. So, Scott, we've been speculating about who killed these people and what is the nature. Is this someone's entity possessing someone? Here's my question for you.
Yep.
Did Kirk just kill somebody? Because if Hengist was a 16-year-old kid that was possessed by this demon, then there's a real person there, and they just killed him.
But, well, I think because we saw that this is not a typical human in the sense that this energy force is able to leave a body.
Right.
And when it does leave the body is inert. It's lifeless. So the life force is what he beamed out into space. Because without the life force, the body of Hengist is not dead. It just doesn't exist at all.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. And I would like to ask the people listening, do you think there was a Hengist there that was not the entity that just got killed? Or do you think it was just Rejack? There was no other, and it was okay to send him off and destroy him.
Captain, since you came to Argelius to rest, I suggest you take advantage of the opportunity.
That's a splendid idea, Mr. Spock. I know a cafe where the women are so...
McCoy says...
I know the place, Jim.
And Scotty says...
Let's go see.
That's the line that was
quoted
all the time.
That's the line.
Let's go see. There, so many times with my friends, there was like, there's a bar down. Let's go see. Let's go see became just like the let's do it among my group of friends all the time.
Let's go see.
Let's go see.
I feel like I'm going to start using that line now because of the sentimental value it has for you.
Well, and the joy, and because the joyousness of James Doohan, just like, I'm on a lot of drugs and you want to go to a place with hot women?
Yeah, let's go see.
You gentlemen, in your condition, don't be ridiculous.
And then he turns back to Spock.
Mr. Spock, this cafe has women that are so...
You notice we've now said this at least three times in this episode, and we have never finished this sentence. Women are so...
Oh, you're right.
And...
Spock is giving him look like, really?
And there's a music sting. And Kirk says...
No, I guess not.
And he says...
Alone?
And he's thinking, I think at that moment he's going, do I want to go to the... He's basically going, do I want to go to a strip club alone?
Right.
That's the thought he's having at
and
that moment.
And he has second thoughts.
He goes, no.
And he exits the transporter room. Motions.
Gentlemen.
And they walk through.
Laughing.
And that brings us to the end of Wolf in the Fold.
And you know what? I am totally smiling at the end. This last scene makes me smile. And this is not a coonism. This is a moment that's created by the show in context.
Right.
And it's totally fun.
You're right. It's not
a joke.
Coonism.
It's not a button at the end.
It's continuing the tone that just had been going these last 5 minutes or so.
Exactly. So what did people say about Wolf in the Fold?
Well, Rejack himself, John Fiedler, said, Star Trek is the thing more people stop and ask me about than anything else I've ever done. And as we said in the beginning.
Piglet.
This is Piglet.
Yeah.
And more people have asked him about Star Trek. Because it plays all the time. They didn't have all the technical stuff that came along later. So what they did instead was rely on good stories. Ain't that the truth? The one The Eye Was In was a good story with a few trick effects. So there you go. And he's absolutely right. It was all about the story. Yep. But again, I challenge anybody listening to put together a YouTube of Piglet with the voice of Red Jack superimposed over it.
Yeah, I'm done. So my feelings about this show are, I think scene to scene, other than the very objectionable exposition at the beginning, I think scene to scene, it works really well. I feel like, and those transitions do work in terms of tone, but I also feel like we left things behind. Like, I don't think we dealt with Scotty's experience as a character. You know what I mean? It would have been interesting. So there are things that I feel like are missing, but moment to moment, I totally find it an enjoyable episode. And I think John Fiedler's performance is fantastic.
I agree.
I think he's great.
John Fiedler is great. And while, you know, Steve, while we never saw or heard any sort of post-traumatic stress from Scotty after his experiences during this episode, it is something that stayed with him. Because in the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Relics... Scotty does make a reference to being in a wee bit of trouble.
Oh.
And he's referencing the events of Wolf in the Fold.
Oh.
So we hear it 100 years later.
Wow.
And by the way, that episode of Next Generation with Scotty, with James Dean, was really, really, really fun.
Yeah.
But I think this episode is really, really fun. You know, it may not have some of the depth, some of the provocative elements, some of the relevant topical elements that we've discussed in some of the other more recent episodes. But I do think that this is an episode that is a solid, fun, entertaining, certainly classic in its own way. And I do love it. Well, this is definitely an episode I would love to hear your comments. What do you think of Wolf in the Fold? What do you think of our deep dive on Wolf in the Fold? Do you agree with us? Do you agree that Dr. McCoy is actually a horrible doctor?
And the best place to answer these questions is on social media. You can visit us on our Facebook page, do a search for Enterprise Incidents, or if you want to discuss it with us on Twitter, well, that would be Enter Incidents. On Instagram, you could go to Enterprise Incidents. And if you want to comment on our YouTube page, we can have that discussion there. Scott and I are fully capable of discussing these questions in multiple places.
And we love to engage with you on Facebook and on YouTube and on Twitter. So please hit us up on Enter Incidents, and please hit us up on our Twitter handles. Steve, what's yours?
Mine is SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. Scott, what's yours?
Mine is Movie Mance at Twitter and Instagram. And be sure to follow us and once again engage with us. Make sure you check out our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify. You can listen to our audio version of this podcast on YouTube. Make sure you share Enterprise Incidents. Please, please, please. I know maybe you think someone else will do it, but please share this podcast in whatever form you think other people will want to listen to it, because whether you're a casual fan, certainly a diehard fan, Enterprise Incidents, we hope that we are doing right by Star Trek by looking at it in a fresh new way, in a serialized way. And absolutely, please make sure you go to Apple Podcasts and write a review of Enterprise Incidents, because that actually helps place us on the charts when you review Enterprise Incidents on Apple Podcasts. But Steve, so after covering Wolf in the Fold, there's got to be some fun episodes of The Cinephiles that are similar.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because while you're at Apple Podcasts, you could go to The Cinephiles and you could see this is kind of a detective story looking for a killer. And maybe you want to check out the classic film Touch of Evil, or another film with Orson Welles that he didn't actually direct, but The Third Man is one of the great noir detective shows. But there's another great killer on the loose in No Country of Old Men. And if we really want to get into serial killers, well, I have to recommend Psycho and maybe the greatest serial killer film of all time,
The Silence of the Lambs. Yes, absolutely. And The Cinephiles, if you just love movies, The Cinephiles is essential must-listen stuff. So next time on Enterprise Incidents, we have another all-time classic. This one with Nomad. I am Nomad. I am perfect. The episode is The Changeling. That's next time on Enterprise Incidents. Join us. And until then, keep going boldly.